You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
And I'd like to welcome you to this forum on technology and the innovation economy. Technology is a great enabler of innovation. In the education area, for example, technology helps us to personalize learning and assess students in real time. In the healthcare area, we are now seeing the emergence of data sharing networks that allow physicians and hospitals to share records and save money and cut down on treatment errors. And for the economy in general, technology has fueled economic development and long-term prosperity. But what are the new advances that will stimulate growth and job creation in the future? What can we do to sustain innovation, and what are the lessons that would enable us to continue progress in a variety of different areas? Today, we are putting out a paper that looks at the link between technology innovation and economic prosperity. Each of you should have gotten a copy as you came in. If not, there's a copy out in the hallway. There's a clear link between technology innovation and economic prosperity. For example, a World Bank study of 120 nations between 1980 and 2006 found that for each 10 percentage point increase in broadband penetration, that it added 1.3% to the gross domestic product of the typical nation. Many countries are investing large amounts of money in digital technology in order to jumpstart their economies. Yet the interesting thing is, when you look at polling data, many Americans are skeptical of our future. An international survey conducted a couple years ago by Newsweek and Intel found that Americans are more pessimistic than the Chinese. For example, only 41% of Americans thought that our country was ahead of China on innovation, while 81% of Chinese felt that U.S. was ahead. So even though we're doing very well, people are worried about the future. They think we're losing our edge. They're worried that other countries are catching up with us. So one of the goals of this panel is to think about the policies that will encourage innovation and what we can do to make America do better and also make Americans more confident about our economic future. In the paper that we put out, we suggest that there are a variety of policy actions that would help on the innovation front. One would be making permanent the research and development tax credit. This is something that Congress seems to prefer to reauthorize on an annual basis and basically torture everyone in the process of will they or will they not at a particular point in time. That creates uncertainty, which harms investment. There's really no reason for that, because there's a bipartisan consensus. This is something we need to do, and we just need to get that done. Secondly, universities play a vital role in innovation, but yet there are some stumbling blocks in the path to commercialization of ideas generated on college campuses. We have another project that I'm not going to talk about today, but we'll be doing some additional work in the future on ways that universities can speed up the commercialization of knowledge. Getting adequate numbers and trained personnel in the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, and math, is absolutely crucial. We're at a point where Americans seem not as interested in getting advanced degrees in these fields, and that creates a real problem for us. And then simultaneously, our immigration policy is making it more difficult for foreign nationals who come here to study to stay if they end up wanting to do that. So we think that there are a variety of policy changes that would help sustain our technology edge and allow us to undertake the innovation that will maintain our economic future. To help us understand how we can leverage technology in a variety of different areas, we have brought together an outstanding set of speakers. To my immediate right is Justin Ratner, who is the Chief Technology Officer and Director of the Intel Labs. Those capacities, he directs Intel's global research efforts on microprocessors, systems, and communications. Justin joined Intel in 1973 and was named its first principal engineer in 1979 and a Intel Fellow in 1988. He was named Scientist of the Year by R&D Magazine for his leadership in computing. He's received several Intel Achievement Awards for his work in high-performance computing and advanced cluster communications architecture. Eric Nakajima is Senior Innovation Advisor for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, so he can help bring a state perspective to this topic. His current efforts include a major supercomputing center to be jointly operated by MIT, Boston University, and the University of Massachusetts with some corporate partners. From 2007 to 2010, he served as senior policy advisor for the Economic Office of Housing and Economic Development for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Prior to that, he worked as a senior research manager for the University of Massachusetts Donahue Institute, which is the university's public service and economic development arm. Our last speaker will be Kevin Richards, who is a senior vice president of federal government affairs for Tech America. He was named to that position in January of this year, and in that role, he leads the association's efforts in terms of getting Congress and the administration to adopt various kinds of policies. Previously, he served as a senior manager at Symantec Corporation, where he managed the federal government relations program. He also worked for more than 13 years on the staff of the late U.S. Senator Ted Kennedy. So I'd like to start with Justin. What do you think is the most effective model for technology innovation, and what can we do to improve cooperation between government, industry, and academia?
Well, thanks, Daryl. It's a pleasure to be here. That's sort of a question I get up every morning and ask myself. We've, I think, prided ourselves at Intel in trying to take an innovative approach to, I guess, what some people refer to as the triple helix of innovation that involves industry and government and academia. And I think in the many decades I've been involved with it at Intel, we've gone through sort of iteration after iteration. We've recently embarked on a new experiment, primarily in industry-university collaboration for innovation. We took a bit of a cue from the National Science Foundation. They, from time to time, have these science and technology centers, which are supported to the tune of multiple millions of dollars a year over a period of 5 years or so. And we essentially created our own fleet of these centers. We call them Intel Science and Technology Centers. Here in the U.S., we've announced five. We plan to have two more. We'll announce later this year and another one in the first quarter. I think you can view ISTCs, the reason I bring it up, as sort of what we believe is the best thinking that's available to addressing the comment you made about how do we become more efficient, more effective, more successful, bringing the best ideas from the academic sector into the commercial sector. And I'll just cite a few of the learnings. First of all, you have to bring serious money to the table. A small grant, as we also do, $50,000, $100,000 a year doesn't get the necessary attention. When you walk in and you talk about spending several million dollars a year or more, as is our case, then you get lots of attention.
That would get my attention.
That would get your attention. So we knew we had to bring serious money to the table. We wanted that money to go largely to the universities, to the researchers, I should say, and not get gobbled up in overhead, which is often the case. We wanted an open IP policy, which has often been, I think, a stumbling block for industry academic collaboration. So all of the work, we actually asked the universities to make a dedication in the public interest of all the results of their work, and we put all of the software into open source. You know, a lot of people question that, even within Intel, question the reasons for doing that. But we really view the university is the best place to do the long-range work. I'm talking about work that's, you know, that's 5 or 10 or even more years into the future. That's very hard to do inside a company. You know, I can't speak for, you know, for everyone here, but I think it's true at most companies that R&D always suffers from what's called the tyranny of the urgent, right? There's, you know, the product for, you know, for next year, you know, for back to school or holiday or whatever it is, and resources just get, you know, just get taken away from the longer term stuff. Another thing we felt was very important was part of the innovation here was having Intel researchers on campus. And you can talk to Jared Cohen at CMU. You can talk to any of our academic partners, and they will tell you that's about the most important thing from their perspective, that this isn't a check-writing effort as so much support from industry has been to the university of to the universities where, you know, somebody writes a check, the money just disappears, some graduate students do some research work, and not much happens after that. You put industry people on campus working side by side with faculty members and students, both undergraduate and graduate students, and that's when the magic happens. And they will, I think all of our university partners will tell you the presence of, you know, real live industry people on campus makes all the difference. We then took it upon ourselves to try to create innovation communities. So rather than funding a single university, we actually ask a particular university, what we call the host school, to engage, let's say, 4 or 5, maybe 6 other universities in the research. And I can tell you that this is driving a level of collaboration that's really unprecedented. Professor Pat Hanrahan at Stanford is the co-PI. He's the Stanford PI. There's an Intel PI at our Visual Computing Center at Stanford, and he will tell you, you know, his email traffic went exponential even before this was publicly announced, because people who had wanted to collaborate for many years but it just never had the right opportunity or the right funding model were suddenly given that opportunity. The excitement was palpable. I remember, you know, sitting in an open air restaurant in Palo Alto, you know, with Pat just bubbling over with the excitement. And you know, at the SIGGRAPH, the big graphics conference, last August, that center and that community of researchers really dominated the conference. And I guess the last thing is, you have to think of your people, this is from the industry perspective, your on-campus people as really part of your research organization and your innovation practice. So they actually report into, in our case, you know, a set of vice presidents that run various research divisions under me as part of Intel Labs. And, you know, they're viewed and they're measured just like any other working researcher. So that's done to make sure that these people become the conduit by which the new learnings, the new ideas, the innovations come out of the academic sector and come into Intel, and we're best positioned to fully exploit them.
Okay, so it sounds like the university role is crucial, and then creating the innovation communities, kind of clustering people, getting a critical mass that can help promote innovation. Eric, you advise the Commonwealth of Massachusetts on innovation policy. Can you describe in a moment what you're doing and what is it that you have found makes for successful innovation?
Thank you very much. I think this is a good time to actually talk about Massachusetts innovation policy. It's something we don't typically come together and describe in detail what we're trying to do in innovation, but one of the reasons why I'm happy to do so is because we believe that recent economic trends, there are performance coming out of the recession, in many ways relates to the economic strategy that Governor Patrick has pursued of investments in education, infrastructure, and innovation. If you look over there, right now we have a 7.4% unemployment rate in the state, well below the nation's. We've added 70,000 jobs since December 2009, which is a 2.2% growth rate. And by a number of measures, whether you look at the Milken Institute or the Kauffman Foundation or even CNBC's rankings of the best states to do business, Massachusetts ranks in the top 10 or even higher, closer to number one. So we think we're doing some things right, and innovation policy has been at the heart of the work we're doing. For Massachusetts, it's actually pretty easy for us to focus on innovation because the only real natural resources we have once the cod fishing was depleted is our smart people, our talented workforce. But if you really think about what it is that we do that's special or secret, it's not actually based on the people. It's based on our ability to invent new industries, reinvent ourselves, and transform our economy over time. That's been true since textiles, pioneering trade with China, computers, or even robotics today. The Massachusetts economy is not the same as it was 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 150 years ago, and that's always based upon innovation and the institutions that help spur that innovation. So it doesn't happen naturally. It does happen through government intervention. I think a great example of that is it's hard to imagine Massachusetts without the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. But if you think about its roots, and you probably know what the roots are, it came out of the Morrill Land-Grant Act signed by Abraham Lincoln. And then if you think about the impact it's had on our economy, the transformational one, that was largely spurred or certainly goosed by federal R&D spending in World War II and during the Cold War. So
the federal government is still relevant to this.
So government, this is exactly, you got the message. Government absolutely plays a role. So the question is, what's Massachusetts doing? Our focus is on supporting the pipeline of innovation from ideation to advanced manufacturing. And there are five basic ways that we're doing that. The first is through investments in research and development. So we're investing in facilities throughout the state, highest level we've done, both at public and occasionally public and private universities together. We're also focusing on new investigator grants. Because we know that we need to have, even though we have a very competitive position right now in innovation, we need to get the next generation of smart folks choosing Massachusetts as a place to do their work. We're also seeding research and development through collaborative matching grants, particularly for industry collaboration and through federal support as well. We're doing that with our Life Sciences Center, Clean Energy Center, and others. So that has been a real focus because, if you think about it, that's a fundamental enabling infrastructure of a lot of the ideation that in transmission and commercialization that occurs. One of the great things we're doing, I think, too, and it follows up on your comments, is we're focusing on supporting collaboration. So you'd mentioned in the introduction the high-performing computing center that we're developing with MIT, Harvard, BU, Northeastern, UMass, and with support from Cisco and EMC. And part of the intentionality of that, apart from the fact that it's a great shared use facility, it's going to improve the competitiveness of these institutions, it was also to spur a conversation between the corporate sector and the universities between each other to incent collaborative research. And as a matter of fact, just this fall, those universities have developed a seed fund to support collaborative research between those universities, particularly in the areas of high-performance computing and efficiency or applications and virtualization that affect that as well, which was something obviously of great interest to Cisco and EMC as well. The second big area is in moving those ideas into the marketplace and supporting technology transfer and entrepreneurship. There are a couple different ways we're doing that, some through support for prototyping, through Catalyst and Accelerator support for proof of concept as well as also through work we're doing, frankly, mostly with the private sector around supporting mentorship opportunities for people who have startup companies or ideas, either coming out of the university or students or folks who are in our ecosystem. A lot of times that's in Boston, but we're supporting that work also in the central and western part of our states as well. The third area is growing companies to scale. And for that, we have programs that are both sector-agnostic through our Massachusetts Growth Capital Corporation, which was formed last year, as well as also through our Life Sciences and Clean Energy Program and the Massachusetts Technology Collaborative, which provides seeds, tax incentives, subordinated loans, and other investments to help companies accelerate, particularly ones that have already significant private sector investment or some level of proof or validation from SBIR, STTR grants as well. And then the two other areas I'd briefly touch upon are one, workforce development. We have a fairly ambitious STEM plan in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is focused on not only improving the quality of STEM education, also rationalizing it, because we've frequently had through our companies and foundations sort of 1,000 points of light and a number of good ideas, many very, very worthwhile. And the question is, how do we have impact across the Commonwealth in a way that provides a little more efficiency and rationality to it, but also gives a signal to foundations in the private sector that their money is being used well? A particular area of focus on that is also trying to encourage women and minorities to choose STEM fields, because I know there's a great gap in terms of their adoption of STEM careers, and we want to do that. And that builds upon the education reform effort we're doing outside of STEM and technology to close the achievement gap. There's a pretty significant effort we're doing there, and the governor, in fact, has increased education funding during the recession. And as we could talk about, that's a choice. It's something that he did consciously because he knew it would make a difference to our economy as well as to the welfare of people in Massachusetts. And the final area is also focusing on taking those ideas and designs when they're made and bringing them to the marketplace for production in Massachusetts. That's not a settled question in terms of how to do that the best we can, but the fact of the matter is Massachusetts has a robust precision manufacturing sector that is already producing world-competitive medical devices and defense technologies and IT products, and so we are working with our MEP and with Association of Employers in Manufacturing to think about ways of supporting ISO certification, workforce development, and other efforts that can help them continue to compete and grow, and also connect to growing innovation fields and reduce that barrier between the leading R&D work that we're doing and the capabilities that are in fact in the backyard of those great research centers. One final point I'd want to make is really about the method in which we approach this work. Governor Patrick, from the beginning when he entered in office, believed that we didn't have all the answers. He came from the private sector. Our secretary also came from the private sector. And so we looked to partner with and leverage the insights and resources of people in academia, as well as also industry through organized collaboratives. We've done that with the creative economy and life sciences and digital industries and advanced manufacturing, and we think it has a number of virtues, among them the fact that we can get a lot of policy consensus around the work we're doing. We also can unearth good ideas that can make a difference in growing our economy. It also does provide leverage because, frankly, the resources we have in this state are a drop in the bucket compared to what we can leverage if we can create the right partnerships, frankly, outside of our doors. And that's worked very, very well for us. I think there are a couple of good examples of that. One is an effort called 12 by 12 that came out of our Tech Hub Collaborative, in which venture capitalists and serial entrepreneurs in Massachusetts are working to mentor young startups, as well as also provide some investment and sit on their boards. Another is Mass Challenge, which I think is fairly well known, which is a global startup competition, which also provides mentorship and various opportunities to meet and approach funders, which is in its second year in Massachusetts. Those things are really privately led, but the state was a catalyst or a seeder for those efforts. And so we're happy to be at the table, and we're happy that they're taking the lead. Another area in which we're, I think, more aggressively involved is the computing center that you mentioned earlier, in which it is not only a great shared resource facility, as I mentioned, it's enabling conversations between a set of stakeholders who, with these great universities, that have never collaborated in the way that they're currently doing. But also, frankly, it's an investment in the western part of our state and one of the poorest cities in the Commonwealth, a place called Holyoke, Massachusetts, which has low-cost power and great connectivity. This is probably the largest private investment outside of a shopping mall in 100 years since its founding, and it's something that we believe is a building block to anchor connections to the innovation economy from Kendall Square and Longwood and the great places we have in the eastern part of the state out west.
That's great. No, it sounds like you have lots of exciting initiatives taking place in Massachusetts. Kevin, Tech America a few weeks ago put out a report on the IT industry and job creation. And here at Brookings, we like data. So can you tell us a little bit about what you found, what the employment patterns are, and what's going on in that area?
Sure. Well, thank you to the Brookings Institute for having me here today. Having been raised in Massachusetts and grown up and raised and born in a town next to an Intel manufacturing facility, I feel right at home at this panel. In terms of, you know, what is the state of job creation in today's innovation economy, By far, the high-tech job creation is really nearly growing four times faster than other sectors of our economy. Tech America releases an annual Cyber States report. We released our latest report on October 5th. And this report is used, relies on data from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. And the report provides a national and state-by-state data on high-tech employment wages, establishments, payroll, wage differential, and employment concentration. And in the first 6 months of 2011, we saw a slight dip in 2010, about a 2% decline in high-tech employment. But in the first 6 months of 2011, we gained those jobs back already. We gained 115,000 high-tech jobs in 2011. High-tech employment in the U.S. is a total of 5.7 million jobs, and the average high-tech wage is 93% higher than the average U.S. private sector wage. The average high-tech wage is about $87,000 versus the average private sector wage of $45,000. And high-tech accounts for one out of every $10 in the U.S. payroll for a total of $499 billion. The leading high-tech states in employment in 2010 were California, Texas, New York, Virginia, and Florida. Michigan actually led the nation in net tech job creation in 2010, adding about 3,000 jobs. We also saw large gains in the District of Columbia, West Virginia, Utah, and South Carolina. And also for the sixth straight year, here locally, Virginia led the nation in concentration of high-tech workers in 2010. With 98 high-tech workers per 1,000 private sector workers. Also, high-tech has accounted for 50% of total venture capital funding over the past four quarters. To give you an idea of the scope of that, biotech and medical devices combined comprise about 25%. And a little bit about what are the enabling factors for high-tech job creation. At Tech America, we refer to them as the four T's. Technology, talent, tax, and trade. On the technology front, we really need a robust federal investment in basic research to create the scientific base that companies use to produce new products and innovations. And also, I might add, to technology, investment in the broadband infrastructure. So communities in rural areas like in western Massachusetts really have the ability to connect to the rest of the world and sell their products globally. In terms of talent, we need to invest in STEM education to provide our children with the foundation of math and science that would prepare them for high-paying careers for the 21st century. And in terms of tax, we really need corporate tax reform. Right now, the U.S. has the second highest corporate tax rate at about 35%. Other nations are becoming more competitive and competing against us. Our research and development tax credit, we recommend making it permanent. The on and off again nature of the current credit doesn't allow companies to do the long term planning necessary to take full advantage of the credit. And a lot of our companies were not around when tax reform happened in 1986. So imagine how much the economy has changed since 1986, from email to the iPad to all the innovations that have come along. We really need to modernize our tax code to incentivize job creation. In the U.S., a lot of other countries are doing it and getting ahead of us and becoming more innovative in how they approach tax reform. And trade, opening up new markets to U.S. products and services. Congress took a giant step forward by approving the free trade agreements with Colombia, Panama, and South Korea. The Congressional Research Service estimates that that will create about 370,000 U.S. jobs. So we believe those factors are enabling factors to helping spur U.S. job creation, and I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Justin, there's been a lot of debate in this country about the pros and cons of investing in green energy and green technology. So I'm just curious from your standpoint, what type of opportunities do you see in this area? Is there much evidence in terms of possible economic impact?
Oh, absolutely. I think the potential impact is really enormous. I think, you know, both in terms of what it can do from an environmental perspective, and I'll give you an example in just a moment. You know, as well as what it can do to stimulate economic growth and I guess most importantly to create new jobs. We have a pretty active effort in energy and sustainability research, as well as a very active effort to make our manufacturing facilities as green as possible. Intel's the number one buyer of renewable energy in the United States. It takes lots of power to run a chip plant, and we work extremely hard to make sure that the water we release from the plants, we're also water intensive, is as good or better than the water that comes in the plants. But let me come back to the research side and what's going to drive innovation. We've particularly focused on something we call personal energy management, given our history and background in personal computing. And I think this may be something that the folks at DOE haven't quite dialed into yet. At least they haven't been actively funding this work. But we think if you can empower the individual with real-time data about how they're consuming energy or allocating their energy budgets, however you want to think about it, that on an individual basis they can make great improvements in how they use energy it's not a huge amount on an individual basis, but if you could get 1% of all U.S. households, that's about 1 million homes, or about 100 or million households, or about a little over 100 million households in the United States. If you could get 1% of them to save in the range of 15 to 30% on energy, they'd lower their energy bills first off. $475, but you wouldn't have to build a couple of coal-fired power plants, peaking plants. You would save about 2.5 million tons of coal. It would be the equivalent of taking 500,000 cars off the roads. And I don't know how many people own a Prius or a hybrid vehicle. Well, I did own two. I just sold one, so my daughter still drives a Prius. But I tell you, I mean, if you're trying to relate to this, whenever I get in her car, the screen that's up, and it was true when my wife drove her Lexus hybrid, the screen that's up is the energy screen. All the other screens, telephone screens, what have you, climate, no. It's always the energy screen, and you're always focused on, gee, what's my instantaneous fuel economy? What's my long-term fuel economy? And so, and the more you can turn that into a game, and if somebody has a question, I'll elaborate on this. But if you can make it competitive, and it's different in different cultures around the world, but in the U.S., we're very competitive. And we like to know, what our neighbors are doing, how they're consuming energy, anonymously, of course, respecting their privacy, right? Hey, Bill, you're really, burning up too much power. No, if you can do that anonymously, they'll compete with their neighbors, they'll compete with their neighborhoods, and so forth. So by introducing, I think, the game element to it, we can really take huge strides in the way we do it, and we can gather so much data, and this is how you monetize it, gather so much data, understanding how people use energy and how people save energy becomes a database that's really worth mining. And the data products that come from that allow entirely new businesses to emerge. I mean, just one is like home appliance maintenance. We have a sensor technology called WEST, which is wireless energy sensor technology.
I like that, by the way.
It's a little block, plugs into the wall outlet, and it has a little processor in it, a little computer in it, and a wireless connection, and it monitors the power line behavior in your home, and can tell you which loads are turning on and turning off. It does it using pattern recognition. And every, you know, light bulb, every appliance has a unique signature. It's like a fingerprint. And as we've continued to refine the technology, we're to the point where the researchers say they can actually tell you the model number of the refrigerator or the air conditioner that just turned on or just turned off. Well, now you think about that. You say, wow, you know, wouldn't the appliance makers like to have access to that data to understand how that's used? Wouldn't service people like to do that? Because the other thing we've discovered, or another thing we've discovered, is as the machines begin to fail, as those appliances begin to fail, their signatures change, right? That the compressor, the electrical transient the compressor puts on the line isn't quite the same when the compressor is about to fail. So, you know, suddenly you've enabled all sorts of new opportunities in home maintenance by collecting this data and making it available to a whole variety of industries.
Actually, I think this smart appliance example is a good illustration of what's emerging in terms of machine-to-machine communications. I mean, we're kind of used to thinking of technology and innovation as people-to-people, but, you know, through appliance sensors and other things, there's going to be a lot of innovation that takes place.
And if I could just sure, add to that, I mean, perfect observation, right? This is, you know, this is the emergence of the Internet of Things, and I really want to underline Internet of Things, because most people hear that and they think Internet of Things. They get all focused on the things and they forget about the Internet. It's really the Internet of Things that's important, because those things are going to talk to one another, but they're also going to create literally a tidal wave of data. I mean, you know, when we talk to the big cloud computing companies, whether it's, you know, Google or Facebook or Amazon or Microsoft, you know, whomever, you know, Baidu, if you want to go outside the U.S., their storage requirements are actually growing faster than their computing requirements. They're being inundated by data. Now, a lot of that, you know, is pictures of the birthdays and, you know, the weddings and all of that. But as the Internet of Things begins to grow, they're going to be inundated by a different kind of data, which is the sensor data that I was just talking about. And we have yet to invent the architectures that can collect, aggregate that data, and present that data in a way for it to be mined. The money is in the data. And this is a huge opportunity for the U.S. to really step out in front, I think, of countries elsewhere in the world. You know, we created the Internet. We invented cloud computing for all intents and purposes. And yet, within Intel, you know, when we compare how our researchers in the U.S. are doing compared to our researchers in China, the Chinese are moving very quickly here. Some of my best Internet of Things people are actually in my Beijing lab, and there's tremendous encouragement by the Chinese government on this topic. And you know, it's something it's a huge opportunity, means millions of jobs potentially, and we've got to stay on it and not get behind.
Yeah, I agree. Data analytics, yeah. You heard it here.
Yeah.
It's the equivalent of plastics in the 1960s.
Right. Yeah, you should have said data instead of plastics.
Eric, what do you see as the biggest barriers to innovation? I mean, for example, in Massachusetts, what are you doing either through policy or other devices to overcome particular barriers?
Well, I mean, if you listen to businesses and you listen to people at our universities, the conversation earlier about pipeline and STEM pipeline, and if you look at the trends over the last 20 years, we're really great at producing smart people, but also frequently those smart people end up leaving and going to California or elsewhere. And so we have to make a concerted effort to improve the connections between young people who are coming out of our universities and job opportunities. We're doing that through internship programs. We actually have a great internship program at our Life Sciences Center that matches students from the community college level straight up to the graduate level with paid internships with companies that also then match that funding. We have done it the last couple summers with over 100 young people each summer, but now we're starting to do it in the fall as well. And we're also doing it through exposing young people to STEM careers as well. and improving the experience between translating what they learn in school, whether it's at the college level or at the youth K-12 level, to what they're experiencing in companies, to encourage them to go into STEM careers, but also to get better awareness to Massachusetts's rich diversity of potential future employers and sort of envision themselves in those careers. I think another area that we are working on is supporting research and development capacity. I mean, when you, again, listen to both companies as well as universities, there's a great, great concern that federal support for research and development is going to either be stagnant or wane in the coming years. And Massachusetts particularly, as great as we are in a lot of things we're doing, the reality is we are incredibly dependent in terms of our innovation pipeline on funding that's coming out of DOE and NIH and NSF. We get, I think, our disproportionate fair share of funding out of NIH every year. I know it was 11% of all national funding a couple of years ago. Now, that's competitive, so this is stuff that's being earned by the great institutions we have. But the fact of the matter is, in the absence of that funding, that pipeline of ideas is going to be more difficult to come by, even though, obviously, many of our great discoveries come out of people who are in private companies or who are consulting on their own. So that becomes a critical concern. What we're doing, as I mentioned earlier, is trying to bolster our support for research facilities, investigators, and also matching funds for university-based and sometimes industry and university-based responses to federal solicitations. So one thing we are doing right now is trying to put in place a innovation fund, a research and development matching grant fund, which would be a $100 million fund that would support collaborations between either public or public and private research institutions in the state. So responding to federal solicitations or opportunities to collaborate with industry. We're doing that marker down precisely because we believe if our institutions are collaborating, it'll make them more competitive for federal solicitations. It'll also, frankly, break down silos that'll allow for accelerate innovation out of the universities or connecting with our companies. And so that's another area that's forthcoming in the near future.
Okay. I have a question for Kevin, then we'll open the floor to questions and comments from you. There's been a lot of talk about America losing its competitive edge. In fact, you referenced that in your earlier comments. First of all, is that really true? And are there lessons that we should be learning from other countries in terms of what places like China, India, or various European nations are doing that we're not doing?
Sure. Well, I think in terms of the U.S., it's not so much of a question of whether we're losing our competitive edge or not. The question is the rest of the world catching up to us? And I think the answer to that is yes. It is certainly a more competitive landscape than we've seen in years past. I think that our great college and university system, such as in a state like Massachusetts, is really our competitive advantage versus the rest of the world. And I know China is trying to replicate the U.S. Education system, and they're also making great investment in their infrastructure overseas. They're going to have, I think it's more high-speed rail than anywhere in the world that's projected by 2015. So they're really making a sustained investment in their infrastructure, their education system, also in intellectual property and patents. They're also buying a large number of patents. But I really think that the U.S. today leads the world in the innovation economy because of our intellectual property and our investment in that area and research and development from years past. Symantec, the corporation I worked for before joining Tech America, was founded through an NSF grant in 1982. Many innovations in the iPad come from our national labs. And I think that we are at the envy of the world. I think a lot of other nations are trying to catch up to us in terms of intellectual property. You'll see a lot of struggles between U.S. corporations and Europe in terms of the areas of IP, for example. I think the free flow of information is with cloud computing and other areas is certainly an emerging area. The U.S. has a chance to lead the world in cloud computing. Tech America Foundation recently released a report. We had 71 cloud commissioners from 71 of the leading U.S. cloud providers. at the urging of the administration, release recommendations around cloud computing and how we can continue to maintain our competitive advantage there. So I guess the short answer is we really can't stand pat. I think that Congress and the administration needs a forward-looking innovation policy. I think that the Congress's approach to innovation is very parochial. There's several committees that have jurisdiction over technology and innovation policy, so it can be a struggle to have laws keep up with the pace of innovation. I think it was Andy Grove at Intel that said that high-tech operates six times faster than your average business, and Congress operates three times slower than your average business. So that's a 9% gap in how those areas operate. So I think that the rest of the world is becoming more competitive, and the U.S. Needs a more sustained investment in research and development. We need to do a better job protecting our intellectual property, and we need to open up new markets because 95% of the world's population resides outside the United States.
Okay, thank you. Let's move to questions and comments from the audience in the back row right there. There's a microphone right behind you. If you could give your name and organizational affiliation, and we'd ask if you keep the questions brief just so we can get to as many people as possible.
Steve Winters, local researcher. Since we're here in D.C., I'd like to ask about the innovation culture at DARPA. Now, that seems to be rather unique. I know other countries have tried to copy it. Is that something that could be generalized to other places in the U.S.?
Well, I've been a DARPA PI, and I have a DARPA contract right now. I'm not the PI on it, however, so let me kick that off, let everybody else chime in. I think, DARPA has a remarkable history. As I've said publicly and, on other occasions, I'm not sure that they're doing what they used to do. And in particular, it's creating these communities of researchers, really the best and the brightest. When I was a DARPA PI, I was back in the late 80s and early 90s. The community of researchers that DARPA assembled was clearly second to none globally. Extraordinary collections of people. I think that has certainly waned in the several decades since then. Part of our motivation in the science and technology centers for insisting that the universities create communities of researchers around the topics of interest to us was driven largely by our experience with DARPA a few decades ago, our belief that that is an extraordinarily powerful model and one that needs to be, reborn, if you will, in the U.S. And, if we have to do it from the industrial side, if the government's not going to do it, we're going to do it because it's so important. And it benefits not only Intel. I think it benefits all of American industry. I'd really like to see that notion flower once again at DARPA.
Okay, right here on the aisle up front.
Hi, Chris Fall, Office of Naval Research. Efforts at the state level and maybe initiatives from Congress aside at the executive branch, we really don't have innovation infrastructure to speak of for long-term planning. What do you say to people? And sometimes by design, maybe the industrial model, ground up, is better. What do you say to people who say we shouldn't have models like the Fraunhofer in Germany and closer coordination between, industry and federal government?
I guess I'll start off. I think that in terms of an industry point of view, we find the public-private partnership extremely valuable. I don't think that the government can't recover the economy and the private sector can't do it alone either. And I think that, for example, when you look at the relationship with research and development, for every $1 the federal government invests in research and development, it gets five private sector dollars returned to the economy. And the private sector needs access to that off-the-shelf technology as well. I'm not the technologist on the stage, so I'll defer to you about that relationship. But I find the partnership, and we do truly see it as a partnership, because the government can't do it alone and the private sector can't do it alone. And I think based on a U.S. model, I think it's an extremely important relationship.
I think it's an interesting case about how you organize the federal government to do this. I mean, is sitting here in Brookings, I think this is a perfect place to talk about regional innovation clusters, and a model that basically says that the conjury of people that you would bring together to have that conversation and forge that partnership is most likely to exist in regions of the country, as opposed to sometimes across states, sometimes within states, as opposed to at a national level. Doesn't mean there's not a purpose for national level policy discussions, but I would say that in terms of the work we're doing, and I hinted or directly stated this in my comments earlier, that absent collaboration with industry and voices in the investor community and academia, we would frankly not be able to wisely spend whatever state resources we have, or frankly have a proper view into the directions in federal research and industry trends that would allow us to wisely partner. I frankly, along with that, though, I would argue, again, as I mentioned earlier, the opportunities for leverage are also there as well. That the fact of the matter, you know, if you think about how we typically view of government, and maybe this is true in state or municipal governments more than federal, people tend to think of agencies providing direct services. So there's a need out there, and you want to find the need, and you want to go out there, and you want to solve the problem. And so you look to government to try to figure out how to solve that problem. Our philosophy, and particularly on innovation-based economic development, is that our role oftentimes is to deal with the foundation, infrastructure and education, broadband, STEM education, things like that, facilities that we need to have at our campuses, which are absolutely critical to whatever those people in those buildings are going to end up doing with it. But frankly, when it comes at the center point of ideation and of commercialization, we know that the people in the private sector or the investigators know better than we do, and they're at that leading edge. And so, frankly, our role at the table is oftentimes as a convener, as a catalyst, and as a seed funder, more than it is anything that's being directed. And I don't know how you do that, my point is, unless you bring people together and forge that partnership and have that collaboration. If you don't have the conversation and you're not listening, there's no way you can come up with the policies that can greater facilitate that private sector success.
I'm going to take a flyer on this one and suggest what would really be useful, coming from the federal government in particular, is one or more. I would just take one. I would be happy with one. Vision for the future. You know, we always cite any discussion about innovation. We always cite, you know, Kennedy's declaration about, you know, putting a man on the moon. But that was a vision. And you cannot overstate the impact that that vision had on just about everything we did in those days. I mean, that vision inspired a generation. You know, I mean, the other gentlemen can speak for themselves, Daryl, as well. You know, I mean, my interest in science and technology rose geometrically, when the thought of putting a man on the moon, was first articulated, I guess, by Kennedy in the early 60s. I don't understand why the federal government, it doesn't really cost a lot of money to do this, can't articulate these visions, whether it's in energy, why don't we have a vision for energy independence? I'm not, don't tell me it's this solar cell versus that solar cell. You know where that goes, right? But, but having a vision of energy independence, I think would be of enormous value. I mean, it would just inspire the academic sector, the industry sector, I think the nation at large just as Kennedy's Apollo vision did. We have an effort underway at Intel to get a conversation going about the future. We call it the Tomorrow Project, and you may have seen it's had some recent coverage in the media. And these are a series of dialogues with thought leaders from all sectors about their vision of the future. And these visions are so important, because the future is not this thing out there that you know, we're just sort of treading water, and, you know, and the future will overtake us. You know, Alan Kay, very famous computer scientist, said, you know, some time ago, Alan says, I make him sound really old when I say that, but he's a good friend of mine. Alan said, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. I mean, the future that we will live in will be the one we create. It's not coming, you know, by Federal Express from, you know, from some office in the sky. And I think we as a nation, you know, have to engage in that dialogue. What future do we want? And then we can set about the business of inventing that future. And I can't think of any better role for the government or really the leadership of the nation than providing the venues to have that conversation and then identifying these visions and advocating these visions. I more than money, I think powerful visions of what we as Americans want as a future would do more than anything else to spur innovation, to spur investment, to create jobs, and to give all of us a new sense of purpose.
I think that's a very important point. But as I listen to the presidential debates, it's like this stuff isn't on the agenda.
No.
You know, those are not the questions that are being asked. But you're right; those are the questions that should be asked. Up front, Mike Nelson over here has a question.
Wanted to start by saying I was really glad to hear the discussion of vision. I had the privilege of working for Senator Gore, both in the Senate and when he was vice president, and the vision of an information highway, along with $300,000 spent on the White House website, did a great deal to push the agenda.
Someday I'll tell you the story about trying to get Intel connected to the internet back in the 80s.
My question was about information policy. I was a little bit depressed when we went through the first round and I heard all the standard things that we talk about when we talk about innovation policy, education, technology policy, research policy. So I was overjoyed when Dr. Ratner brought up data and information. I'm working on a report right now on how companies can develop a transparency strategy and how they can dump more of their data out on the web and they can foster innovation ecosystems by sharing data. But there are all sorts of barriers and problems and challenges here. There's privacy policies, intellectual property policies, government data policies. I'd like to challenge the panel and ask how you would try to foster the kind of open innovation that we're seeing. Yesterday, some of us heard an incredible talk by Chris Anderson, the editor of Wired magazine. He's created an open source drone company. He puts out blueprints on these automated drones that anybody anywhere can pick up the blueprints, can see what they're doing, and build their own. But that's a totally different model, but it's based on sharing, it's based on transparency. So how would you foster that alternative model? How would you make this data available? You gave a great list of things you could do with this data, but companies are holding on to it really tightly. Even government is holding on to their own data and making it impossible for us to leverage it effectively.
Great question.
Thank you.
What do you think? Don't everyone speak at once. That's very rude.
I'm not trying to dominate here. I think the whole question about data is an absolutely critical one. There are challenges that go beyond just the proprietary interests, let's say, that people have in their data. And just as an aside on that, you know, sometimes when you ask the question about why that's their policy, they don't have a good answer, right? It's sort of like, well, we've always done it that way, so, you know, why would we do anything different now? And by the way, that's one of the key questions that innovators often ask. Well, you know, why do we do it this way, right? What about other ways to do it? But to come back to this point, I mean, the technology, particularly the sensing technology, as I said, it's going to generate tremendous amounts of data. That data can be used for both good and bad. And I think as we amass these data sets, we're going to have to give first order thought to the security of that information and the privacy of that information. So while, yes, sort of in general, I think the broader access to that data is to be encouraged, to be lauded. We're not where we need to be in terms of ensuring the privacy of that information. The ability to anonymize that information in such a way that those controls cannot be circumvented. And really to guarantee individual privacy. So while I completely agree philosophically with it, I know in our own work in the area of context-aware computing, we're very concerned that, we will have literally terabytes of data on every person on the planet. And, and you can imagine, the kinds of things that might people might do with access to that data if we didn't institute the proper controls on it. So it's a big data is a big technical challenge, a big engineering challenge, and one that has to be solved within a social context. Because as we know, my children, your children, are much more willing to put that information in the public. Us old folks, don't tell them we're not going to be home this weekend, that kind of stuff. So, there's almost a new social contract that needs to be innovated to really unleash the power of data.
What about export controls that stand in the way of global collaboration and sharing?
We put out a paper in our Issues in Technology Innovation online series that looked at that, because a lot of export controls right now are focused on the export of physical items as opposed to digital information. And so we really need to kind of rethink export policy in light of the digital world.
I was going to add, it's interesting, the order of magnitude of the challenge you posed with your question initially confounded me. One of the things that internally within our government, we actually have difficulty accessing the range of records that we have that would allow us, frankly, to do I'm a guy who comes from doing economic analysis in my background. I'm obviously doing policy and projects now, but I know for a fact that we have data sets that are, by the way, confidential, and confidential for a very good reason, with which we could do an extraordinary regional economic modeling and analysis in which you wouldn't be guessing anything. You'd actually absolutely know what was happening, and that would be a fantastic thing to be able to do. But it's very, very hard to get the protocols set and the agreements set and sometimes the law set to be able to do that. And that's on that macro scale that you're describing. I think on a smaller scale, though, it's something that we are trying to pick up the challenge to do in sort of demonstration projects in a couple areas. One, we're currently working our way through an economic development strategy, a formal one that was mandated by the legislature. So we've kind of had a strategy, but now we're going to have a strategy. But it's been good to generate a conversation, because one of the things that a lot of the entrepreneurs over in Kendall Square in Cambridge have told us is, look, there's just got to be a way to incent more innovation on applications that can use data sets for real-time information, for public health, for traffic, for any number of things on a municipal level or on a state level. And so one of the things we're thinking about doing is putting challenges out there in partnership with some of our regional entities, as well as also municipal entities, to get people to be able to be creative about how they can aggregate some of that information and make it more usable to the public or interactive with the public. Another example of that is, again, out in Holyoke, Massachusetts. I'm doing a lot of work in Holyoke these days. As an outgrowth of our computer center, there's a municipal utility that runs the hydroelectric dam and a number of other things in Holyoke that, for one thing, is 60% green. It's lower cost than other places in Massachusetts, so it's one of the reasons why there's an advantage to being there. But it's also a very innovative and forward-looking municipal utility. And so we are now at the actually urging of MIT President Hockfield and Joe Tucci from EMC and others, convening a workshop in Holyoke, bringing together people from MIT and UMass and some folks in the private sector, as well as ISO New England, to do a workshop to think about how to make that microgrid a demonstration site for the application of novel technologies. But one of the biggest things that came out of those conversations was the desire of the ISO New England and of the utility to organize and mine that data. They're thinking about how do we understand better how we traffic power and over the load. And interestingly enough, they're actually less interested in, we thought they were going to be really fascinated by sort of consumer behavior. They're actually more interested in the aggregate flow of power and making it more efficient than they are necessarily the consumer level. But that's something where, again, as a demonstration project, has a lot to do with accessing and managing data, but also challenging our universities and entrepreneurs to think about how we can do that better and then ideally transmit that knowledge elsewhere.
I guess that I would add to that point, I think information is the lifeblood of today's economy. I think the administration's open government initiative is a good thing. Your question is a complex one because it flows into so many areas. You look at cybersecurity, you look at the cloud. We're currently working with Congress to update the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. What's law enforcement access to information that resides in the cloud? A lot of the agencies with their cloud policy, what they're doing is they're having their own cloud, which kind of defeats the purpose of the cloud model because they don't want other agencies to see their information or necessarily share it. I think greater citizen engagement with the government is a good thing and transparency is a good thing. But also, you know, the government is a massive repository of the public's information, and they should be stewards, good stewards of the public's information. And right now, if a breach occurs at a federal agency, they do not have to reveal that breach to the individual's personal information that they've breached. It would be reported to the U.S. CERT. But I think it's important to keep in mind the government and their responsibility for the information that they do have and take good care of that information.
Okay, there's a question right there. There's this gentleman right there.
Hi, my name is Raul from Pepperdine University. My question is regarding immigration as it relates to highly skilled workers and innovation facilitated through visas like the H-1B, the J-1, and the O-1 visa. The Brookings actually released an article entitled Creating a Brain Gain for U.S. Employers, the Role of Immigration, in January. That in mind, to what ends do we push brain gain when essentially creating a brain drain for emerging markets like that of India, which is seeing an exodus of many of its high-skilled workers?
I'll address that because that was my paper. And I also have a book on this subject entitled Brain Gain. The reason I make that argument is that there are a lot of foreign students who are coming to the United States, who are getting educated, they're getting PhDs in the various science fields. They would like to stay here. And these are the people who've actually created some of our finest companies now. When you look at many of the new technology companies in terms of which ones had an immigrant founder or a co-founder, it's like, you know, it's a who's who of company names. We're giving those people virtually no opportunity to stay here right now. If they happen to be able to get a job right away and their employer can sponsor a visa for them, then they can end up staying. There is a trade-off in terms of them staying here versus going back. Interestingly, between the combination of our restrictive immigration policies and just the double-digit economic growth that is being experienced in India, China, and elsewhere in Asia, more and more of those individuals are now choosing to go back. I don't see it as a complete zero-sum game between us versus them, but right now it is so far tilted in the other direction that between the combination of American students not being interested in STEM fields and having a restrictive policy that doesn't really encourage or allow foreign students to stay here, that is a potentially lethal combination. I mean, we could do well on one of those fronts and probably do okay as a country. Right now, we're screwing up both of them, and I just think, you know, that's the reason I wrote that paper and wrote the book.
Joe? Yeah. I'd like to add to that. I mean, it's absolutely, we're on the record in our administration that we're absolutely in favor of increasing the ability of people who want to come here, and also people who are educated here to be able to stay here. It's absolutely critical for the Massachusetts economy and I think any high-tech region of the country. But just on your other points, I think you're making an interesting observation or hypothesis that there's a zero-sum trade-off between the smart people who get educated here and start companies here and back home. And my graduate school advisor was Annalise Saxanian, and just by coincidence because of the fact she was, and I got a chance to look at her research, she spent an awful lot of time embedded in Silicon Valley and in Bangalore and in China and Taiwan, working with networks of immigrant entrepreneur communities that, in fact, are educated here, start companies here, and then develop very, very rich and dense networks back in their home companies. So, in fact, you'll see a lot of people who are lead entrepreneurs and company developers in India who not only came out of Silicon Valley, for example, but also still have ties back to it that are economic as well. So I think it's more complicated than that, but also the benefits to both countries or parties or people is richer than I think we might anticipate otherwise.
Okay, there's a question right there as well. Yep.
Hi, thank you. My name is Tim Loudon. I'm from the International Labor Organization. Sort of along the same lines as the question that was just posed, last week the OECD released a report that basically showed since 1999, although the U.S. has remained and the number one technology services exporter and provider, and that has increased, the level of percentage of jobs that has been created was severely disproportionate to the level of jobs in that amount of time in equipment and manufacturing that has left the country. So I was wondering what your thoughts are as to whether or not new innovations are just going to amplify that trend and sort of create a lesser amount of high-skilled jobs as in contrast to low-skilled jobs in other countries.
I guess let me start off, I guess, since I offered our cyber states report. I think that the U.S. economy has been mostly an industrial-based economy, and we have not really made the transformation to the information age economy. There are, when I say that 95% of the U.S. population is overseas, a lot of that has to do with markets overseas and being closer to the customer. There is manufacturing overseas. There are a lot of incentives offered by companies to manufacture overseas and be closer to the customer. But in terms of Michigan, which has just come out of our Cyber States report, they rank eighth nationally in high-tech component manufacturing exports. And that's one of the reasons, and you look at the automakers and what they're doing, and I was on MSNBC last week, and one of my taglines was that this is not your grandfather's car anymore. And you look at the number of innovations going into automobiles and the ability of innovation to cut across platforms from several sectors. I think from the data that I've seen, consumer electronics remains pretty strong in the U.S. But I think that our policy has to catch up with the business cycle and the transformation that we're seeing in the world economy, and we're not necessarily there. I think that when I talk about Congress operating nine times slower than our industry, it's very true. And to add to the last point on immigration, I think, you know, since 9/11, we've seen a lot of changes, obviously, in the world, and I think one of the unfortunate results of those is a fortress America mentality, where the founders of several of our companies came from overseas, and a lot of folks still want to come here to live their American dream. And if they're not allowed to do that, or it takes 7 years to get a green card, I think there is a lot of incentive to go back overseas. And I think that's one of the policies, immigration, that we have to take a look at to have more of a balanced approach to the global economy.
The question right here.
Thank you. I'm Paula Stern. I have my own consulting firm, the Stern Group, but I used to chair the U.S. International Trade Commission, and I wanted to insert the question about U.S. trade policy being part of this vision as to what the federal government should be doing and how we assure, from a business point of view and from commercialization of technology point of view, that the U.S. Has a trade policy in place that enhances our competitive advantage. You mentioned intellectual property, and particularly for smaller companies, maybe not Intel now at this stage in your development, but for smaller companies, the concern that they have about how to share their technology when they go to market, particularly with regards to China, where while they're members of the WTO, they may not really, from a cultural point of view, feel the same way about intellectual property rights protection or sharing, by the way. So I'm just wondering about your thoughts on the 21st century trade policy that you would like to see the federal government have. You mentioned these free trade agreements. I think that's fine, but that's really your grandfather's trade policy. And I'd like you to think big thoughts and big ideas about our trade policy in this globalized economy. Thank you.
Sure. Well, if I can start off, Tech America Foundation is actually starting to take a look at this. We're putting together a paper. I think that our trade policy for the future should be based on intellectual property protection. It should account for be built around information, transporter data flows, and the free flow of information. I think the Trans-Pacific Partnership is starting to go that way and look at how we modernize policy, but I don't think we necessarily have to do this in a piecemeal approach by trade agreement. I think there should be more of an overarching philosophy when it comes to modernizing our trade policy. When we're dealing with other countries that have a different outlook on intellectual property, I think such as China and some of the challenges there, I think that is the rest of the world is looking for that edge. And I know when we're up against market access barriers, some countries, in order for us to sell in the market, will ask for our IP, for our company's IP, to reveal it. Because I think they know that's the secret sauce and they can't necessarily catch up on their own. And I don't think from a macro level, economists are cognizant of the challenges around intellectual property and the transformation that we need to make. But look for that paper. We're in the early stages, and I think we need a forward-looking trade policy that has to account for information and IP protection.
By the way, if my comments about open IP and university research gave you the impression we're not concerned about IP whatsoever, we are, right. We have a 65 nanometer fab in Dalian, China. We did not disclose any semiconductor process technology as part of that agreement. It's way out of my area. Trade policy is not something, fortunately, I need to worry about. But we do think there's an opportunity to be more astute about these things, in ways that you sort of don't fully appreciate until you're in country, I guess is the way to say it. A few years ago, we got into, quite a spat with the Chinese because they were trying to enforce a different security protocol on Wi-Fi. And, Wi-Fi is an international standard, and along comes, the Chinese. There was actually an individual who sort of came up with this idea, Chinese professor came up with the idea. The next thing you know, the Chinese are saying, okay, you're not going to be able to sell any Wi-Fi equipment in China unless you run the security protocol. And we're sort of going, whoa, wait a minute. If you guys want to create your own wireless standard, okay, that's interesting. But don't drive this right in the middle of Wi-Fi because you're going to shut things down. And eventually that was reversed. I think the Chinese government realized that was going to be a real mistake for them, and so I think part of trade policy is bringing them more fully, not picking on the Chinese here, but I think that's a good case in point, bringing them into the world community beyond just a WTO membership, and helping them realize that it's a huge opportunity for them if they work in a global cooperative way to do, among other things, drive these international technology standards, as opposed to the mindset that often emerges, which is, well, China has to have its own thing, right? And we've got to create a different standard. So there's definitely work to be done here, and I think, you know, Intel would strongly support the efforts to encourage them to be a true global partner in these technology standards.
I didn't add it earlier too. Cybersecurity is another area we have to look at in terms of trade policy. Are we going to negotiate cyber treaties? Are we going to have a cyber ambassador at the UN?
That's why I stopped on the other question. I went, oh boy, we could really go to the races here.
Yeah, that's a different panel. Right?
Yeah.
Okay, we are out of time now, but I want to thank Justin, Eric, and Kevin for sharing their thoughts for a very provocative session here. Thank you very much.
Thanks.